I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. My thanks to Tony Cox for sitting in this week so I could participate in the Aspen Ideas Festival. And I was reminded again of how important it is to have the right to discuss ideas freely, and that millions around the world are denied that right and are fighting for it. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a reporter who wrote about the 2009 pro-democracy demonstrations in Iran and paid a very heavy price. That conversation in a few minutes. But first, back to a pressing debate in this country. The deadline for raising the debt ceiling is approaching fast. Yesterday, President Obama spoke to reporters at the White House, and he pressed congressional leaders, particularly Republicans, to be more open to compromise. That party's leaders have demanded major spending cuts in return for a higher debt limit, but have rejected any Democratic calls to raise revenue, especially by raising taxes. President Obama scolded GOP leaders as inflexible in his remarks yesterday, and called for an end to tax policies that favored people like corporate jet owners and the oil industry, as well as for, quote, millionaires and billionaires. And at one point, the president compared lawmakers unfavorably to his own children when it comes to meeting a deadline.
Malia and Sasha generally finish their homework a day ahead of time. Malia's 13, Sasha's 10. It is impressive. They don't wait until the night before. They're not pulling all-nighters. They're 13 and 10. You know, Congress can do the same thing. If you know you've got to do something, just do it.
Actually, I think Malia is almost 13. I think she has a birthday coming up. But in keeping with the theme, President Obama took Congress to task for spending too much time in recess and not enough time addressing priorities like the debt limit. And in response to that, Senator David Vitter, a Republican of Louisiana, responded this way.
Let's stay here next week. Let's not recess. Let's not even have a pro forma session. Let's work. But let's not be here just to be here. Let's be on the floor debating in a constructive way the biggest challenge our country faces, which is spending and debt.
Well, we don't know at this point whether that will be constructive, but Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has now canceled the 4th of July recess for the Senate anyway. So we thought it was a good time to talk about what this continued standoff might mean for the U.S. economy and actually for our own pocketbook. So we've called upon Marilyn Geewax. She is NPR's senior business editor. Also with us, Wall Street Journal economics reporter Sudeep Reddy. They've both been with us before to try to unravel all this. Welcome back. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Sudeep, before we start, I want to just get some clarity on one point. The Treasury Department announced in May that the nation had already reached the approximately $14.3 trillion debt ceiling. So how is it that we're still functioning financially despite that?
The Treasury Department actually has a number of accounts that it can use to move money around to delay what is considered the inevitable of running out of money. And that's what it's in the process of doing and what it's been doing since mid-May. It's been drawing down accounts that it will pay back later. It's been borrowing from a fund that is generally used to help other countries in foreign exchange operations. It's doing a lot of unusual operations. And
so
it's
kind of what we would do.
Exactly.
Right? If our paycheck was delayed, we'd be kind of borrowing.
You're tapping every
from
credit
Peter
line
to pay Paul.
And you'll have somewhere. That's why it's not really a precise date around August 2nd, and there's a little bit of flexibility around that, but we know that we're really running out of time, running on fumes right now.
So here is the money question: what happens if the debt ceiling isn't raised by August 2nd?
That is the interesting question. There's a reason people say that it would be catastrophic, that this is a really dangerous proposition, and that's nobody really knows what the problem would be. The U.S. is seen as the reserve, the dollar is the reserve currency of the world. Everybody around the world has put their faith in the U.S. that this will not be a problem. And that's why it's just inconceivable what would happen if this is a problem. That's when you start hearing about financial calamities, financial crises that the likes of we've never seen before. And that's the risk, is that nobody has any idea the depth of what would happen.
Marilyn, what would happen to individuals if the debt ceiling isn't raised? Are there ways in which we as just regular people would experience this?
Absolutely. I've talked to a number of economists about this to try to track down what would be the impact on people. And one thing just right off the bat is a hike in interest rates. Now, here's the way to think about this. For every dollar that the government spends, we take in about 60 cents. So there's 40 cents short all the time. We are always running short. Now, to make up that difference between what we spend and what we take in, we've got to borrow money. Well, people loan us that money pretty cheaply, dirt cheap, really, because they assume that the United States is going to pay them back and there's really no risk there. So we have very low interest rates. People all over the world buy our treasuries. But what if we, on August 2nd, say, hey, wow, great, thank you very much, Chinese investors and people in Europe. We appreciate your support, but we're not going to pay you back. Well, that would certainly cause potentially all sorts of chaos. But at the very least, even if they thought sooner or later we'll straighten it out, they would want a much higher interest rate. So interest rates would go up for treasuries to get people to continue to loan us money. Now, those treasuries serve as a benchmark for all sorts of other kinds of interest rates. So if you have a credit card, a home equity loan, things like mortgage rates are very closely tied to what treasuries are doing. So anytime you would have a hike in treasury interest rates, it will filter out to all kinds of things from your home, your car, your credit cards, everything.
So it's in the way that, say, if you had a credit card and you missed a payment and the credit card company said, okay, you know, not that you would, but to say, Marilyn, okay, you missed a payment, so I'm jacking
I'm
your
rate up.
Right. That's what
and
would
it
happen.
Happens all the time with other people who are borrowers. If you don't pay your bills, then the interest rates go up. And that's whether you're a corporation, whether you're a person, interest rates go up. Or even worse, at some point, they'll say, you know what, I'm just cutting you off. I'm not going to loan you any money. So if we're spending a dollar, we're taking in 60 cents, we're running short all the time, we need people to loan us that money. And if they don't, we're either stuck with, number one, much higher interest rates, or much more catastrophically, no money.
We're talking about efforts to raise the national debt ceiling. We're talking about what might happen if that doesn't happen. Our guests are Wall Street Journal reporter Sudeep Reddy and NPR senior business editor Marilyn G. Wax. That's who is talking just now. You know, the thing about it is that both sides seem to be really dug into their positions. I mean, the Republicans are saying that that they're not willing to raise the debt ceiling without this commitment for deep spending cuts. And they're saying they're not willing to entertain, because they say, look, you know, it's gone on too long, that it's long past time to sort of rein in the size of government. They say, look, we campaigned on this. This was our promise to our constituents. End of story. And they say that tax breaks aren't feasible right now because that will further stall the economy. The Democrats and the president are saying that it's an unbalanced approach. It's unfair. That too few people have reaped too much benefit from too little of a sector of the economy. It's time to balance it out, and that if you don't, and that too deep spending cuts will be too damaging to the economy. It just, these seem like irreconcilable positions.
It's a very tough debate right now because both sides have, in a sense, truth to both sides of it. On the one hand, let's say if you say we're not going to raise the debt ceiling and we're going to make this into a crisis, let's push this because we've got to do something about this uncontrolled debt that we keep running up year after year. So if you do that, you could – let's think of some other economic impacts. The first thing, most economists estimate about 800,000 federal workers could get furloughed. That means people who work at, say, the Department of Veterans Affairs, they would be out of work. Well, we already have a terrible job market. Do you really want to see another 800,000 people, you know, not working? But there's also all these government benefits that might not be paid. Just in the month of August alone, Medicare and Medicaid will spend about $69 billion. Well, if you're a doctor or hospital expecting to get that Medicare payment and you don't get it, maybe you lay off nurses and staff, and it ripples out tremendously throughout the economy. So the people who say, such as Secretary Geithner, this is much too risky. We can't risk having higher interest rates. We can't risk doing this to the job market. It's just too risky. Don't do this. Republicans, on the other hand, say this has gone on long enough. There is a risk in doing nothing. We have to address this underlying fact that we just spend 40% more than we take in. And so at some point, you have to draw a line. Those are the two battle lines.
Sudeep, what are economists saying? You know, there's this old joke, if you want, you know, five opinions, ask four economists. So I just have to assume that there is a wide variety of opinions about this. But I'd like to know what some of them are about what the effect of this could be. Does anybody not think this would be a dire situation?
There are some people who think that the U.S. would actually have a little bit more time than we say. But when you're already running on fumes, there's only so far you can go to push this out. Everybody understands, and that's what's so maddening about this, everybody understands that this is a self-defeating proposition. If you don't pay your bills, then interest rates are going to rise, not only for consumers, but for the government. And then all that money that the U.S. spends in servicing its existing debt will actually it'll cost more. And so then you're taking money away from all those other programs, and you have to cut even more out of the budget in the end. And so everyone really sees that. And I think economists have generally understood that, at least mainstream economists have understood that both Democrats and Republicans have been rather disingenuous in this. Democrats have not fully acknowledged that this is an urgent problem and that you have to make some kind of cuts. They don't necessarily have to take place today, but they have to be in the plan for the coming years. And Republicans have been especially disingenuous in suggesting that you can solve this problem merely by cutting the small parts of the budget without getting into some other areas. They've certainly talked about other areas like Medicare, but even the House Republican budget, which passed with all Republicans in the House voting for it, would add $6 trillion to the debt and require raising the debt ceiling to over $20 trillion. And so to say that they don't want to support raising the debt ceiling is just ridiculous, because the budget they pass would require the debt ceiling to be raised.
So finally, Marilyn, before we let you go, we only have about 30 seconds left. Is there anything that I hate this term, but I'll use it, average citizen can do? Like with Y2K, they said, put water in. Is there anything you can do to prepare for this?
Well, just make sure that your own house is in order. If, say, you're a federal worker, you may be facing a furlough. So if you are dependent on that government check in one form or another, make sure you've got plenty of savings. But, of course, that's not very good for consumer spending. So that's trouble there, too.
Marilyn Geewax is NPR's senior business editor. Sudhi Reddy is an economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. They were both kind enough to join us once again in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you both so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you, Michelle.
The next time you're delayed by rain or snow at an airport, consider this. It's possible that an airplane actually caused that bad weather. NPR's John Hamilton reports on the surprising things that can happen when plane meets cloud.
In 2007, a plane full of weather scientists flew through a very odd snowstorm near Denver International Airport. The storm was unusual because it left only a narrow stripe of snow leading away from the runway. One of the scientists on the plane was Andy Heimsfield from the National Center for Atmospheric Research. He says the team realized that the snow was following the exact flight track of two turboprop aircraft that had taken off just a few minutes earlier.
The quite amazing thing was that their flight track actually produced about an inch of snow at the ground.
Heimsfield says he and his colleagues were pretty sure the planes had made that snow fall. But how? Research in the 1980s found that airplanes, especially those with propellers, can cause ice crystals to form when they fly through certain clouds at just the right temperature. So it seemed plausible that planes could trigger a little snow. And Heimsfield found evidence that they often did. But as he used satellites and airport data to study the phenomenon, he realized that a single aircraft could also cause snow to fall for miles around.
So the thing that piqued my interest was, how the heck you go from a little line that an aircraft makes and produce something that's many kilometers across?
Heimsfield and his team found an answer by studying precisely what happens when an airplane flies through a very special type of cloud. The cloud has to contain water that's below freezing temperature but hasn't frozen yet. When an airplane comes along, its wings and propeller cause pockets of air to expand. That expansion reduces the air temperature, pushing it below a critical point where ice crystals start to form. Then a sort of chain reaction takes place, causing the ice crystals to radiate outward, sometimes for miles. And ultimately, the crystals fall out of the sky as snow or rain, sometimes leaving behind a visible hole in the cloud layer. It's called a hole punch cloud.
Oh, they're unbelievable looking. It looks like if you took a white sheet of paper and used a hole punch. It just, you wonder how the heck could something like this happen.
Heimsfield says his research suggests these clouds form surprisingly often at certain airports after airplanes take off.
Of course, they take off into the wind. And so that snow, which would be generated, would then go over the airport.
You could have the airplanes cause their own weather delay.
Oh, absolutely.
But most of the time, the extra flakes don't make much difference. And the cloud formation that's left behind is of more interest to cloud spotters than travelers.
It
can look like a very dramatic and unusual cloud formation.
Gavin Prieter-Pinney founded the Cloud Appreciation Society and is the author of The Cloud Spotter's Guide. He says that before people understood how hole punch clouds were made by planes, they were sometimes mistaken for the exit path of a flying saucer.
You see photographs of them and you do think, God, there's something strange there. That's not natural.
But Prieter-Pinney says the fact that they're also not supernatural does not make them any less attractive or intriguing.
Each time one understands a little bit more, one engages a little bit more with them, one pays a little bit more attention to them. And for me, that means one's a little bit more aware of their beauty and value.
The new study appears in the journal Science. John Hamilton, NPR News.
This July 4th weekend, flames and smoke will rise over backyards across the country. Americans will be grilling.
In the best case scenario, you get a tasty meal.
In the worst case, you get an awesome story of how you turned hamburger into charcoal briquettes or how you got grill marks on your hand.
Stephen Reichlin wants to help you stay on the right side of that line.
Can I just mention for people, you're really comfortable putting your fingers in the fire.
I've been doing this for a while, so
okay. Right.
Yeah.
Reichlin is the author of the Barbecue Bible. The other morning, he fired up three grills in a backyard and then slipped back inside to the kitchen.
So what we're going to do is an entire meal on the grill, from appetizer to dessert.
Okay.
And we're going to do sort of a celebration of regional American barbecue.
Regional
American barbecue.
So we're going beyond hamburger and
hot dog. Right.
Okay.
And
not that there's anything wrong with that,
okay.
But anyway.
Reichlin has spread out the ingredients on the kitchen island. He's got a slab of Alaskan salmon and a cedarwood plank to grill it on. He's got spices for Mexican corn on the cob, as eaten in Chicago, and he sliced open poblano peppers to stuff those green peppers with a mixture of
onion, cumin, garlic, pinto beans and black beans with grated pepper jack cheese.
He's brought in bread and butter and garlic to grill Texas toast. And off to the right are several pounds of uncooked pork.
Our meat main course today, pulled pork sliders, with a nod to South Carolina, spice rub, smoke roasted pork shoulder that'll be chopped and served on grilled buns with mustard slaw, mustard sauce.
Should I mention the barbecue sauce in the Carolinas is a little different than what Americans might be accustomed to elsewhere?
Absolutely. Well, in North Carolina, the barbecue sauce is a vinegar sauce. And in South Carolina and Georgia, the barbecue sauce is a mustard-based barbecue sauce. So that's what we're going to do today. Finally, to finish up from Georgia, cinnamon grilled peaches with vitamin B3 glaze. And those three vitamins are brown sugar, butter, and bourbon.
I'm ready to go.
Yes, we are going to grill peaches on one of the three grills that are already smoking outside.
So now what I'd like to do is we've kind of done all of our prep.
Okay.
We're going to head outside and we're going to get to work on the grill.
Three factors will affect this meal. The first is the food itself.
All right.
Wow, that is a lot of pork. That is a big hunk of pork.
So what we have here is a pork shoulder,
right,
also called a Boston butt.
Mm-hmm.
The next factor is what you put on the food before it's cooking and while it cooks.
After the first hour and every hour thereafter, this is called a mop sauce. It's a mixture of vinegar, mustard, and spices.
And you've actually got a tool that looks like a little mop.
And it is a little miniature mop. And we swab this over the meat. It adds an extra layer of flavor. It helps keep the meat moist, and it looks really cool.
And the biggest factor, of course, is the star of the show, the fire.
Just realized I was about to set the microphone on fire there. That might not be good.
One of our grills runs on gas. The others are simple kettle grills, which he's gradually filling with charcoal. Or not really filling.
Remember, there is a difference between grilling and burning.
Stephen Reichlin has a way of measuring the charcoal, dropping a bit at a time from a container.
You know, when people start out, they kind of build a raging fire and throw the food on and then somehow hope by some divine miracle that it will come out grilled. But you want to control the fire. That's why we work with multiple heat zones, hot zone for searing, medium zone for cooking, safety zone with no fire whatsoever.
Reichland thinks about just where he places the coals and where he places those stuffed peppers on the grill.
And so I'll simply arrange them on the grill.
And we're not putting them directly over the flame.
Right.
Then.
We're putting them in between the mounds of coals. That's why it's called indirect grilling.
Direct and indirect grilling. Direct grilling means the food is right over the flame. Indirect grilling means you've pushed the coals off to either side.
Anytime you grill something that is either big or fatty or needs a prolonged cooking time, or you have a dish with a filling like this one where you actually want to cook the filling through, as well as the peppers on the exterior, you use indirect grilling. Because if we direct grilled, we'd char the peppers, but the filling wouldn't be done.
And indirect grilling is what he uses on that slab of pork shoulder. He drops some water-soaked wood chips down into the charcoal. They'll give a smoked flavor to the meat, and then he puts the cover on.
Okay.
All right.
This is why the neighbors have been insane since 6:30 in the morning, because we did cook a pork shoulder ahead of time. Cooking time on this is about 3 hours. And what you can see, it's a beautiful, crusty, golden brown. It's so tender. I can just pull little pieces of pulled pork right off the meat. And
do you mind if I do
that? No, absolutely.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
Wow, I'm just going to grab a little bit
there.
Yeah,
for quality control purposes.
Pretty hot.
Yeah. So, indirect grilling. About 3 hours adding wood chips every hour, but not the last hour.
Now, the average person looking at this might fear at first glance that they had burned the meat because it's blackened in a lot of places.
Well, there's a difference between black and very dark brown.
Slaving for hours in the smoke under the sun, Stephen Reichland has grilled a perfect slab of meat, which he'll now take back inside and destroy.
And then with a cleaver, we actually want to chop the pork into a fairly fine hash.
He's turning it into the filling for a pulled pork slider. Drop the meat on a soft roll with some slaw and eat.
Now, this is a gob-o-food. Wow.
Yeah.
Mmm. That's fantastic.
It's a very complex set of flavors and textures.
Textures, yeah. Some parts are really crunchy, some parts are really soft.
Yep.
And we're going to follow it with peaches, speared on cinnamon sticks, and basted with that brown sugar, butter, and bourbon directly over the flame of the grill.
You see how the ends of the cinnamon sticks are burning? And that releases all those cinnamon oils.
You're all for that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all about flavor.
Actually, not quite all about flavor. For Stephen Reichland, it's also a kind of performance art.
One of the extraordinary things about grilling, it's a public event. It's a theatrical event. It's a social event. People do not gather around a stove to watch a pot of soup simmer or an oven to watch a cake bake. But when you grill, instantly you have a crowd.
And you can crowd onto our website for recipes and photos at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Factory managers in China are paying the price for success. As everybody knows, countless American businesses have relocated to China in search of cheaper labor, and now the cost of that labor is rising. David Wessel, economics editor for the Wall Street Journal and a regular guest here on Morning Edition, is just back from China. David, welcome back.
Thank you.
So what's changing for American companies?
Well, I think one big thing that's changing is that China is no longer a nirvana of ample low-wage labor. I was in an industrial park about an hour from Shanghai where one factory has opened every day for the past 12 years.
We're talking about thousands of factories in this one industrial park.
Correct.
This must go for miles and miles.
Correct. 400,000 workers. And imagine what it's like to be a boss there when you treat somebody badly or they want a raise and you say, no, you can't have a raise. And they say, okay, I'll go next door. So it's really become a worker's paradise of sorts for people who have the skills to work in these factories.
So the equation has completely changed from having a massive pool of labor that you could always get somebody to replace a worker that wants too much money to the opposite situation, and wages are going up.
Yes. So one thing that companies are doing is moving plants more into the interior of China, where there's still a lot of farm workers who are looking to come to the factory, and the Chinese government is encouraging that. So I think it's making a big difference in the calculation that American companies will be making now and in the future. The production that requires really, really cheap labor will leave China. It'll go somewhere else. It'll go to Vietnam. I was in a Gap store in Shanghai, and I looked at the T-shirts, and they said, made in Malaysia.
Well, let me ask about another implication of that, because, of course, American jobs have been moving to China forever. Would American factory managers, American executives at some point begin to think about moving jobs back to the United States where wages have stagnated?
That's a great question, Steve, and my initial instinct was no way. But I was surprised by an initial report by the Boston Consulting Group, which says that some jobs may actually come back to the United States if they are things that require not much labor, so they're in very highly efficient plants, mm-hmm. and they involve things that are heavy to move. So, for instance, appliances are very expensive to ship. So some of the Chinese labor cost advantage is going away. That means other disadvantages like transport or supply base or nearness to customers may come into the fore.
One other possible benefit or effect for the United States, if Chinese wages are rising, does that mean that more Chinese workers will have more money to buy products, some of which might be American products?
Yes, but a lot of the money that they have will be spent on made-in-China products. And there's also a huge problem that a lot of the things they buy may have some American input, but they're ripping them off. So we have to make sure, and this is a big issue for American companies, that American intellectual property, if that's what we're really selling to China, is protected and not ripped off.
As you traveled around China, did you get a sense of an economy and a system that felt sustainable right now?
I was struck by two things. One, the incredible momentum and how fast they've grown and how widespread the evidence of that growth is. But as you talk to people and examine the economic foundations, I was struck by the fissures in the foundation, that they're having a hard time coping with inflation. Mm-hmm. There's a tension between free markets and people acting as they want to act and the political repression. The income inequality in China is astounding. Within 50 yards, you can see a mansion that looks like it was in Potomac, Maryland, and a hovel that looks like it was in pre-Great Society Appalachia.
David Wessel, economics editor of the Wall Street Journal, just back from China. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.